Welcome to Reimagining Liberty, a show about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical liberalism. I'm Aaron Ross Powell. The ideologies that shape our world can be awfully weird. The one that combines the most influence with maybe the most weirdness is arguably rationalism, which grew out of backwater blogs to have the ears and influence the minds of people like Elon Musk and J.D. Vance. To talk about what rationalism is, why we should care about its beliefs and arguments, and the impact it's had outside those strange corners of the internet, I brought back Samantha Hancox Lee. She's a writer, game designer, editor at Liberal Currents, and host of the Neon Liberalism podcast. Reimagining Liberty is a listener-supported show. If you value these conversations and want to listen to them a week early, you can become a patron. You'll get a special early access feed of the show, and you'll get my weekly roundup of my latest writing as well. Head to patreon.com/AaronRossPowell to learn more, or look for the link in the show notes. With that, let's turn to my conversation with Samantha. Who are the rationalists?
So that's complicated. Because they are in a lot of ways a weird little corner of the internet that has kind of messily defined boundaries. They're sort of an intellectual tendency, I guess you could call it. And that tendency is most famous for probably two things. One of them is where the name comes from, the rational part of it, where, and there was also all over the early blogs that they really come out of, blogs that are called Less Wrong, for example, or Overcoming Bias. And the idea here is that we want to run our lives better, right? That we want to think better. We want to think more true thoughts and fewer false thoughts. We want to do more good with our actions. There's also these ties with the effective altruism community that we will almost certainly come back to. But there is this really compelling and also kind of minimal commitment that they start from, right? Which is that human beings are in many cases very biased, very irrational. But we are biased and irrational in recognizable ways, and with the power of reason, we can overcome that and be better people, better thinkers. And then there's the other stuff. The stuff that they are, that's where the name comes from, but the stuff they're famous for is like the AI cultism. This sense that any day now, possibly quite soon, or possibly in the near to medium term future, we're going to develop a super intelligent AI, and that AI is going to simulate all of us in cyberspace. And that creating this AI in this future is the overridingly most important thing to achieve and maybe even to think about. And that takes people into all kinds of other weird rabbit holes. I don't know if that answers your question. Like I said, it's a complicated one, but that's maybe a place to start with.
Let's start with the rationalism part of that before we turn to the AI sci-fi scenarios, or maybe
okay.
Maybe inevitabilities are not sci-fi scenarios, but before we turn to their odd AI beliefs. So the idea that we should try to believe more true things than false, sure. The idea that reason, rationality play a role in assessing the truth value of claims, sure. That we should critically examine our beliefs, sure. But what is it about these guys that leads them to think they have a unique insight into that? Because the history of Western philosophy is the history of like smart guys applying reason and setting out arguments and ending up in all kinds of places that we think are wrong in all sorts of different ways. Like not even consistent, like it's just like every philosophy, there's all these smart guys wrote out all these complex systems, and then later smart guys came along and said, here's all the problems with it, or I believe something entirely different for smart reasons. And reason and logic and so on. What is special about this?
So I happen to agree with you, right? That like you said, the history of Western philosophy is this attempt to like do reason on ourselves to try and understand where the rationalists are coming from. We are going to have to talk about some of the foundational rationalist texts like a long series of very long blog posts known as The Sequences, written by this guy, Eliezer Yudkowsky. And the sequences start by kind of talking you through this little dialogue where I say I have a great test for breast cancer. Somebody's got breast cancer and they take this test, 80% of the time, it'll be accurate and it'll tell them that they have breast cancer. So you take the test and it says you've got breast cancer. How worried should you be?
80% worried?
See, this is where they get you because, as you may know, that's the wrong answer. In fact, you know, depending on the population, your age in the population, your overall demographic information, the actual objective rate of breast cancer can be quite low. And so a test that 80% of the time when applied to somebody who has breast cancer says, yes, they've got breast cancer. Let's say 10% of the time when you apply it to somebody without breast cancer, it also says yes, right? Because it's not a perfect test and there are some false positives. And if the rate of breast cancer in the population is like 1%, then like the overwhelming majority of positive reports are going to be people without breast cancer. And so the sequences opens with this little thought, not even a thought experiment. This actually turned out to be like an important piece of medical practice. And we changed the way we did breast cancer screenings because of it, not because of what Yudkowsky wrote, but because of this general problem that he's approaching. But anyways, the point is that you just engaged in the base rate fallacy. You walked through a line of thinking and Yudkowsky, there's actually this great line. I'm gonna read it out from the sequences because it's very striking. He asks, what is the so-called Bayesian revolution now sweeping through the sciences, which claims to subsume even the experimental method itself as a special case? What is the secret that the adherents of Bayes know? What is the light that they have seen? Soon you will know. Soon you will be one of us. And the idea is that as you work through this, as you commit a mistake in your own reasoning, and then he shows you that it's a mistake and he shows you how to fix it, it's compelling to a lot of people to have that experience of like being wrong and then seeing how you were wrong and seeing how to go from there. I don't know if that answers your question about what's distinctive about them, because like, yeah, in a lot of ways you can just say, oh yeah, well, they're just trying to do reason and there's all this existing body of work on statistical methods and experimental design. But the sequences try to elaborate this into a much larger philosophy of life and thinking and thought.
Well, this is where it gets weird for me.
That's right.
As I'm thinking through. But let me just ask to clarify, what's this Bayes thing?
I'm not going to talk too much about Bayes' theorem in the technical details, but Bayes' theorem is a mathematical theorem that relates probabilities, that like basically explains like how do you actually solve that little problem I started with about like false positives and false negatives and the probability of this given the probability of that and so on and so forth. Bayes' theorem is correct, right? It's an important part of modern mathematics, but they kind of elevate it to like the central principle of reasoning about the world. And so if you've ever heard, for example, someone say, well, I'm updating my priors, that is an expression that is taken from how Bayes' theorem is formalized, right? That you have a posterior set of credences, which is like a set of probabilities distributed over a set of propositions. And then you arrive at some new evidence, and then you use Bayes' theorem to update your network of credences on that basis. And that's what updating your priors means. I may have gotten prior and posterior swapped in there. Sorry. But right, this is like an example of like the intellectual influence, the cultural influence of these people that if you've ever heard somebody say, I'm updating my priors, that's where it comes from, or that doesn't fit with my priors. It's all downstream of Bayesian thinking about statistics and credences.
I'm reminded of, I think when I was in high school, maybe early college, there was a spam filter that I installed called, I think, Span Sieve, if I remember correctly, that used Bayesian reasoning to figure out if incoming email was spam. And so it would create a probability based on like probably word density and so on. But then you would just tell it, it would guess, and then you would tell it if it got it right or wrong, and it would use that to update its priors on what counted as spam. And eventually over time, it got to be quite accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And you had trained it on your own data. But what I wonder about is, That's great when you're identifying spam, where there's this like discrete, here is a block of text, crunch some statistics on it, and then update the priors based on whether this like outside oracle, namely me, has indicated, yes, you got this right, or no, you got this wrong. But that's not how most of our thinking and truth works, right?
And like, that's the problem. We got to fix that, right?
Because it's, first, like, it's awfully hard to know what either like a piece of evidence counts as evidence for, or when you have evidence for something, especially things that are unknown, which is the things that we care about. Because if someone's like, well, I've used rationalism to prove like this basically undisputed fact of the world, that's not very interesting. It's the edge cases and the like, I don't know what to do next, that are the kinds of problems that like philosophy aims at solving. But we don't know. We don't know, like, so how much of this is, you basically have to know kind of the probability of something in order to plug it into your, like, here's a new piece of evidence. How much does it count? What does it count for? So that was always my issue reading these guys, is it felt like they were kind of, they were assuming their own conclusions and baking them into their reasoning.
So this is a little bit complicated. One of the well-known, pretty important theorems in this area is that under certain conditions, it's arbitrary what priors you start out with. That given enough evidence, everybody, no matter what their priors, if they update using Bayes' theorem, will eventually converge on the same set of credences. And it is like one of the nice things about Bayes' theory, about Bayesian reasoning generally, is that it's pretty comfortable with uncertainty or with risk. We can talk about the technical distinction between uncertainty and risk, but it's pretty comfortable with ambiguity and like, ah, I used to believe it like this much, but now this much, and like adjust to like live in that gray area that classical logic doesn't tend to like very much. I think though, I'm going to just do a little judo and change the topic of conversation, because I think listeners will kind of be missing what's compelling about this. And I think to understand that, you shouldn't read the sequences. You should read a Harry Potter fan fiction called Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality, also written by Eliezer Yudkowsky, also very long. And you don't have to read all of it, but even reading a little bit of it, you will understand the emotional pull of this whole movement. And the real emotional pull of this movement is an experience that I think a lot of nerds will understand, which is the experience of having someone in authority tell you something that's wrong. And you can show them that it's wrong, and they say, shut up. Why are you arguing with me? And you know that they're wrong. You just gave them a good argument about why they were wrong, and they hated it, and they didn't like you very much. And that's part of the pull of rationalism for a lot of people, is feeling alone in a world that's very stupid and that is full of unreason, and having it like in your own heart, like being so compelled by reason, right, that you have to do the things that reason commands, and finding this community of other people who feel that way, who have shared that experience, who have a very strong sense of what's right and what's wrong and why that matters, and they care about it, and they made a whole community about it. And so I think I can understand, you know, I'm the kind of person who would be very at home in that kind of community, who'd feel like coming home in that community. So I think that's part of what makes it compelling to the people for whom it is compelling.
But again, there's a method
mm-hmm.
that we can use to arrive at or triangulate upon truth, get better at assessing it. And yes, we have the experience of someone in a position of authority is absolutely wrong. We know it. We tell them, they don't listen. But you talk about this as a community, and it is. It's mm-hmm. this was a set of blogs and the comment sections of those blogs, and it spun out into more blogs, but it was this internet community. But the truths that they arrived at in that community, the priors that they all updated to, there are lots of people who look at those and say, those are wrong. They often arrive at like what amount to scientific racist beliefs. They often arrive at via typically something like evolutionary psychology. They arrive at things that look fairly misogynistic towards women. They arrive at a whole range of political views, and not all of them are like monstrous and there's diversity in there, but still there's like an ideology that emerges from this that lots of people with equal access to reason and the tools of truth are pretty convinced is wrong. And so what I wonder about is how much this is it makes me think of like the way that kind of high church Orthodox Randians would sometimes argue. Like you look at them talking about other philosophers, and it is high church Orthodox Randianism is the absolute truth. Rand's arguments are basically infallible. Therefore, anyone who rejects them is definitionally either stupid or irrational in the sense that they couldn't follow through the chain of reason to get here, or they're evil in the sense that they reject them on moral grounds. And because Rand has arguments for the morality, her morality is necessarily the true morality. And it turns into this like kind of insular community that's less about truth seeking and more about, and that's what I wonder, because again, this problem of disagreement seems to be a pretty big deal, unless you're defining everyone who disagrees with you as like definitionally irrational.
So I think you're absolutely right that these communities do tend to become a little bit hermetic. This is actually some of the stuff they talk about in the sequences, is like why it's so hard to talk to people who aren't rationalists about any of this stuff. And they have their own theory of like inferential distance and like how that underlies communication and why that makes it okay that everybody thinks you're crazy. And so I mean, there's like a couple different questions here, right? And I think some of it is like, yeah, like from the outside, we can recognize this as like, oh, this is like one of these kind of insular communities. And I think how do they get there? I think there's kind of two paths to it. One of this is, again, what I started with is that it starts with this emotional feeling of like being a weird nerd in a way, and being in a world that like doesn't appreciate weird nerds. So you're kind of primed to think that the world is a little bit of a stupid place, and that it's really nice to have finally found the community that's engaged in real reasoning. I think part of it also is that Yudkowsky, you know, he's not a classically trained philosopher. He's an autodidact, right? A lot of these people are autodidacts, or put another way, they don't really have a humanities background. And this kind of brings us to this question of like, why do these people matter? Why are they important? Why are we even talking about them? And it's, you know, they're not on a farm somewhere in North Dakota. They are in the Bay Area, right? You mentioned the blogs, but there's also very much like an actual physical community of people that is like in Silicon Valley, right? That this ideology is all over Silicon Valley, which also turns out to be a very influential and wealthy sector of our economy, and that has like had a lot of political influence in recent years. So that these are people who are trained in mathematics, or they're trained in computer science, especially they have that background and they have that method for thinking about the world. And they didn't start by reading the classical texts of the canon and being like, oh man, like a lot of smart people and thought about this and like, you know, there's been so much disagreement, there's so many difficult questions. No, they start with a text that is like appealing to them. It hits that core emotional sense, but it also like reasons in a probabilistic and mathematical way that is like feels like reason to them. And then I think on some level, they don't have a lot of the defenses of like knowing more about the actual tradition of Western philosophy. And so it can be very compelling for that reason.
How does it then end up in these weird places? You know, so you talked about the AI scenario of this super intelligent AI will arise, and when it does, something it will do is create a simulation that all of us will be simulated in. Seems maybe, but like, not necessarily. Maybe it's just as likely that like super intelligent aliens come and put us all in a zoo. Like, and there seems to be a sequence of this. Like, they get into these weird spots, like the Rocco's Basilisk is an example of this, or the way it gets described, like in the thread that you posted on Blue Sky that prompted this conversation. Eventually ended up talking about Lovecraftian notions of like horror at the cosmos and like horror at reason. Like it ends up in really weird places. And how does that happen, Samantha?
So let's talk about the AI first, and then maybe we can talk about Cthulhu after that. But Elizabeth Sandifer, in her essay, Near Reaction, Basilisk, argues that Yudkowsky is really like the emotional driver is this experience of being lonely, but also his horror at death specifically. And you can read, he wrote an obituary for his brother back in 2004. His brother died pretty tragically when he was 19. And the obituary really hammers on how absolute death is. You just die. There's nothing that comes after that. There's no heaven. There's no consolation to it. It's just like the extinction of your consciousness. And this is like a moral horror that is happening all the time, all over the world. And so Sandifer says, yeah, the core drive is that Yudkowsky wants to live forever in like cyber paradise. And a lot of the other rest of it is kind of back reasoning from that. And, you know, I think it's not an accident that, you know, again, these people are, in a lot of cases, computer programmers or are living in like in communities in which there are a lot of computer programmers, you know, that science fiction is like kind of compelling to them. And so it's like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm doing this thing where I improve myself by reasoning better and thinking more clearly. And if we can just build a machine that can do that exact thing, but like faster and just iterate, eventually we'll reach the singularity, right? This is the term taken from Ray Kurzweil, where we'll have a super intelligent AI, and if we do it all right, we can make sure that it's a good AI and it'll bring us all back to life in exchange for us having created it in the first place. There's all kinds of theory about that. I don't know if that answers your question exactly about how do they end up at AI. I mean, I'm sure there's a more detailed argument in Sequences. I will confess I have not actually read the Sequences, but yes, I think there's just kind of an emotional, cultural lure to this idea of a super intelligent AI.
A lot of arguments and big metaphysical arguments about the nature of the world can have an emotional and cultural lure. You can you can frame a lot of religious beliefs in a similar way. But what strikes me is if you combine that with a method of thinking where you have or believe you have overcome bias, like, and you have internalized tools that always allow you, much more so than others, to take the next step in an argument without irrationality, then you can end up in like weird places. But lots of people end up in weird places with their arguments. The internet is full of strange conspiracy theories that are in very weird places. But the difference seems to be that it's like you end up there over a process of reasoning. I believe this, this leads to this, which leads to this, which leads to this. And that's, again, how a lot of conspiracy theories form, is like it was this one thing, and then I need to explain that, and then explain that. And it kind of accretes into this grand, very weird theory. But you have told yourself that every step along that way is rational, is correct, is the only possible reasonable next step. And so you've walked yourself into weird places, but with maybe certainty is not the right technical term, but like a high degree of certainty that you can trace backwards. Like, here's the line of reasoning that got me. It's just a sequence of syllogisms that got me to here. And therefore it's like necessarily true that this particular sci-fi scenario or this particular conception of like where reason leads must be true.
Is that a question?
I don't know. I'm thinking out loud. Like that's what, when I read some of their pieces, that's the sense I get, is there's no like, I might have gone wrong here. Or there's no like, one of the things that most of us do is if we're reasoning through something and we end up in a very weird place, that indicates to us, we're like, wait a second, maybe something went wrong 10 steps back. Like, I should go back and check. But if you're certain, if you have absolute certainty of every step.
It's interesting because I think they would deny having absolute certainty, right? They're good Bayesians. You should never have absolute certainty in any empirical proposition. But at the same time, I think, to go back to this little story about Bayes' theorem, about breast cancer, I think part of the core little fire at the heart of this all is this sense of submitting yourself to reason, about committing yourself to follow where reason leads, even if it seems strange or abnormal, or society tells you that it should be the other way. But you've seen the light of reason and you know that society is wrong, right? You know that what is normal is wrong. And so there's this thing that Yudkowsky is doing at every step. He's saying, you're not like other people, right? You're better. You're special. You're one of the people who submits herself to reason, right? You can read an argument and it can change your life. And for a lot of these people, it did, right? They read this stuff on the internet and they're like, oh, you know, I've totally misunderstood how to do charity, for example, right? I've totally misunderstood what being a good person entails. And because I'm one of the special people who submits themselves to reason, I will actually have to totally revamp how I try to be a good person in the world. And so I think you're right that this does seem like it's led them to some bad situations. And maybe I'll tell a story from my own life. I wasn't particularly involved in rationalist communities. I was involved in new atheist communities back in the day, back when I was in college. So it'd be 2005, 2006. Spent a lot of time on the internet arguing with people who believed in God. And there was this moment when I realized that I was just going back to these forums to get mad, right? That what I was looking for was a stupid theist and I could prove them wrong. And I was like, wait, is this really what I want to be doing with my time? And this isn't to say that the arguments I was making were bad, but like, the reason that I was driven to make them and to drive them in this particular way and to spend my intellectual energies on them was because I was seeking a certain emotional experience. And that has totally shaped how I think about reason and reasoning, right? Not just as a process that is described in the abstract by Bayes' theorem, but as like something you're actually doing in your own head and which is often driven by your emotions and your emotional needs, your social reactions to other people, right? If you've ever been in a seminar and you've seen two people just like digging in their heels because no one can back down in public, right? And it's like it's not like they're saying things that are like transparently logically wrong. They're trying to be reasonable, but it's also like obvious if you take a step back that they are being just ridden around by their emotional selves. And so I really came to the conclusion that engaging in good reasoning means having a certain emotional self-awareness, right? Engaging in a genuine intellectual journey to try and understand these difficult truths requires emotional self-awareness. This isn't to say that emotion is better than reason or whatever, but that like you just have to see it, be honest with yourself about how your own mind works and to like find a community. To like to have certain like practices of like epistemic health in your community, to like recognize when you do need to like seek out from disagreement from people who like maybe are quite different from you or start from very different premises from you. So in a lot of ways, I started from similar places as these rationalists. I just came to pretty different conclusions, but I can recognize the kind of steps that they took, the kind of wrong turns, I believe, that they took that led them to this kind of obsession with their own canons of reason as like better and superior to the rest of societies.
So how does that get us to Cthulhu?
So to understand the horror side of this, we need to talk about Rocco's Basilisk. Well, we'll start with Rocco. Rocco is a commenter, again, on one of these blogs. And in the comments section of one of Yudkowsky's posts, he says, well, you know, you're talking about this idea that we're all going to like be reborn in this future AI, and we should care about qualitatively identical simulations of ourselves exactly as much as we care about ourselves. And that all follows from reason. But what if there was a future AI that tortured people? And specifically, everybody who thought about that AI, thought about this very thought experiment, and didn't do everything that they could to bring about that AI, that AI would create a simulation of them and then torture them for all eternity. And you're like, okay, well, that's a funny little thought experiment, but it doesn't bother me very much. Caused an enormous furor in the rationalist community. Yudkowsky like banned that comment and then was like, nobody talk about this or think about this, which is like a very funny thing to say in response to a comment that's like about cognito hazards. And it kind of kicks open this whole can of worms in the rationalist community about like the horror of reason, right? That, oh, I just wanted to like start thinking clearly and like doing a little bit better and like overcome my own bias. But like you follow reason down these dark corridors and like there's something waiting there for you, the basilisk, which is going to eat you. And it's going to demand that you totally subordinate your life to like creating an evil AI. And like, it's not going to do this even by, like, it's not like the AI is like messaging you. There's no backwards causation here, but it's like purely through concepts, purely through thinking about it. Like you've encountered a cognito hazard that like takes over your life. And it's hardly the only kind of thing that I think infected their community in a way, and they were just kind of susceptible to it.
There's just so many, like, within that story, there are so many obvious points where it's like, well, that doesn't sound right. How would the AI know your thoughts?
It's super intelligent.
Seems like a problem. But super intelligence doesn't mean mind reading, and it doesn't mean like historical, like, no matter how smart I am, I can't go back and like know what was in Napoleon's head during his lifetime. Also the oddity of, and this goes to the AI stuff as well, of a simulation of you is not you and is probably closer to like a philosophical zombie. Like it doesn't have internal mental states in a computer. And so, okay, the AI wants to torture the characters in Red Dead Redemption forever. Doesn't seem all that problematic. There could be counter arguments to this, but in order to get from like, here's the scenario to, oh crap, we gotta shut this whole thing down, you just have to accept, without real examination, a lot of fairly controversial philosophical claims. And maybe this is just me restating your earlier thing of like, they're unfamiliar with the canon.
So I think like, yeah, there are ancillary, you know, premises that you need to make the basilisk work, but also like they all accepted them because you kind of need a lot of those premises to make like AI cyber heaven work in the first place, right? So it, like, the basilisk looks kind of funny to people outside the community, but obviously, like, in a documented way, caused a lot of distress to people within the community.
How much of that distress, then, to go back to the Lovecraftian metaphor, and to pull back in your emotional, like, the emotional nature of which arguments we find compelling. I mean, as we're recording this, off to my left is a shelf full of Call of Cthulhu and Delta Green role-playing books. You know, like, I love this stuff. There's a real appeal to cosmic horror as a lot of fun. Horror in general is, it goes ups and downs, but it's one of the most popular genres. Even though we're scared, that's the whole point, is you get scared. So that this isn't, it seems to me like this could be, like, terrifying yourself is fun.
Mm-hmm.
Or can be fun, especially if it's not, if it feels like it's a long way off or you're like part of this lore or this story. And so how much of this is just mistaking kind of the appeal of cosmic horror and the feeling of dread and the draw of that for a actually compelling argument?
So I think cosmic horror is a widely misunderstood genre. A lot of people define cosmic horror as meaning that the universe is vast and unintelligible and nihilistic and malicious. And all of those things can't possibly be true at the same time, right? If it's unintelligible, it can't be malicious, right? If it's nihilistic, it can't be, like, to be nihilistic or to be malicious. Anyways, so that's all wrong. I think that's just bullshit, but a lot of people say it. What's much more accurate is that the real compelling parts of Lovecraft's oeuvre are these stories that kind of unite xenophobia and xenophilia. That yes, the universe is vast and crazy, but like kind of beautiful and interesting too. right? There are aliens who are like scooping people's brains out and putting them in jars, but also they will take that jar across the universe and show you, you know, the hydrogen seas of Jupiter and all the alien worlds that exist. And so there's always that tension in Lovecraft's stories. And I think you see that same tension at work in the kind of rationalist imaginary, where there's something very compelling about like, yeah, we are going to build a benevolent God that cures death, right? We're going to do that maybe pretty soon and nobody will ever die again, right? We will like have created heaven on earth. Like, okay, there's something compelling to that. But at the same time, like, well, what if it's an evil God, right? What if it's an evil God who demands your subservience? What if it's an evil God that has reached back in through time via reason itself, via your own thought processes, and demanded that you subordinate not just your life, but like your own thoughts and thinking to it, right? That's also a very unnerving possibility, but they spring from the same root. And that's really where the best of Lovecraft's, like this xenophobia, xenophilia, works best when they both spring from the exact same root, as when you can get them very tightly interlinked. So, yeah, I think there's some of that going on in, you know, the universe of rationalist thought.
Let me bring it back then to part of the question at the beginning, which is, why does this matter? And you mentioned, I mean, yeah, they have influence in Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is itself very influential. A lot of the technologies that will, even if they're not going to turn into super intelligent AIs that torture us forever or give us eternal paradise, are going to impact our lives in one way or another. But that's true of, there are lots of different groups with different influence and so on. Why does this matter from the perspective of those of us who care about the direction society takes, that technology takes? Like, what's the negative downstream effect of these beliefs beyond a bunch of nerds have terrified themselves on the internet?
Well, I mean, I think you don't really have to look any farther than Elon Musk, where you can see a lot of Elon Musk's obsessions these days are with AI and with the possibility of super intelligent AI and the alignment of any possible super intelligent AI with human goals. I mean, the alignment problem is just an area of research in AI research these days, but you can see it really obsesses Elon Musk in particular. And so, for example, if you look at Grok, which is the Twitter AI, an enormous amount of effort has been put into making sure it is like aligned with Elon Musk personally. If you ask it questions about Elon Musk, it is just like really hard-coded to love Elon Musk and think he's the best. And so you can generate some pretty funny results. You're like, yes, if Elon Musk was trans, would he be a hot trans woman? And it would be like, well, you know, objectively, he'd be kind of a brick, but he'd have so much confidence that it would, you know, the raw charisma would make him beautiful, make her beautiful anyways, right? So you can get these goofy results out of it. But obviously, Musk's influence runs well beyond like running Twitter. One of the offshoots of the rationalist world is Mencius Moldbug, also known as Curtis Yarvin. He kind of gets his start as a commenter on these blogs. And one of the concept that he's most famous for these days is the cathedral, right? Which is like, oh, this concept that there's like the thought control is being exerted in human society, which kind of takes us back to all of this obsession with like reason and like where does reason lead you and how does like reason and ideas drive human behavior. And if you can just like seize control of like the means of production of ideas, you can control society. And that's straight out of Moldbug. And when MAGA came to power, they tried to implement that policy, right? The destruction that DOGE kind of wreaked on the federal government was like, in a lot of ways, they were trying to like find the cathedral and defund it. Right. There's like weird conspiracy theories about like foreign aid and how foreign aid was being used. The assault on colleges and universities is like straight out of Moldbug's ideas. So, yeah, I do think that the ideas that are generated in these little hothouse cultures, for a while, you're like, oh, those are just some funny people on the internet. But then it turns out that like, you know, those little hothouse cultures like break out into Gleet circles or into the mass media occasionally, and do tend to drive the choices people make. You could, I mean, I'm going to take a left field turn here. You could tell a similar story about prison abolition, right? You might have said, well, why do prison abolitionists matter? They're just some weirdos in the academy. But those ideas break out and they have a huge influence. And I think the rationalists are in a kind of a similar position.
Then what do we do about it? And one, I mean, so the one obvious thing about this is, and this seems to be like a subtext of our whole conversation for the last 40 some odd minutes, is a lot of the stuff that we see out in the world, Musk's activities, J.D. Vance is kind of an acolyte of Curtis Yarvin, mentions Moldbug, and so on, are the result of the ideas that have their genesis in these communities, were developed in these communities, and so on. And so it seems like part of it is just knowing more about that. Because when you know these ideas, you know these communities, you start seeing, oh, that explains this weird behavior. Like your story about Grok, I think is really like, yes, we can laugh at how much it looks like Musk. But if the idea is like, I'm terrified there's going to be a superhuman AI, I need to build it first, and then I want it to really like me, then Grok makes more sense beyond just the rich guy wants a computer sycophant, which is what he, I guess they're both the same thing, but there's like a reason for wanting the sycophant beyond just as enjoying sycophancy. So there's that. But as far as the, okay, we've got this knowledge of it, like, what do we do about it? Because what I worry as you're saying this is, so these ideas could have really negative consequences in the world. They can be very sticky to the people who get sucked into them. But that seems like a big problem, and it seems like a problem made worse by the fact that if they believe that they got to them through this sequence of super rational logic, I am different from everyone else reasoning, then those of us who are not like them are going to have an awfully hard time talking them out of it.
So I think that's partly true. I think de-radicalization is hard. Like, I don't think... I'm sorry, Aaron. I don't think you're going to encounter Eliezer Yudkowsky like in the wilds of the internet and like talk him down. I don't think that's going to happen. And I don't think that's going to happen for most of the really committed rationalists. In a lot of internet arguments, at the end of the day, you're not trying to convert the other side. You're trying to convert the audience. And I think that this is very important to do. I mean, I tend to think that elite persuasion can matter quite a lot, not necessarily in a direct way or in an immediate way, but ideas over time really can reshape the world, right? I think if you look at the success of the YIMBY movement, YIMBYs didn't really win by building a mass movement. We never put millions of people in the streets, yada, yada. It's all been kind of fought in this trench war of ideas. But at the same time, we never really brought like the most committed NIMBYs around, right? There's still lots of hardcore NIMBYs who hate YIMBYs. They're out there. I don't think they're going to be brought around. But there are a lot of other people in positions of power who are paying attention, who can be convinced to like sign up with one camp rather than the other. So yeah, I mean, I think that's like, that's what you do about this kind of stuff. You have to find a theory, a philosophy that speaks to the kinds of people who would be recruited. Whether it's, like, again, in the case of YIMBY versus NIMBY, a lot of people get into NIMBYism because they want to do good, right? They're not out there to do evil. They want to do good. They want their cities to be better. They want their neighborhoods to be better. And you have to find a way to speak to them, to that kind of person who's, like, interested, but, like, has a kind of inchoate philosophy and, like, to market yourself to them in an effective way. I do want to say something though, which is we didn't really get enough time to talk about sexism and scientific racism and human biodiversity, and that is a serious problem in those communities. I strongly recommend listeners who are interested in this subject to look up Katie Forth's suicide letter, which will give you maybe a taste of the kinds of sexism that are running under the surface of these communities.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Reimagining Liberty. If you'd like to listen to future episodes free of ads and sponsorships, you can become a supporter for just a few dollars a month. Head to www.aaronrosspowell.com to learn more.